Welcome to the Forging Honor Podcast. I'm Jonathan George.
And I'm Benjamin Jones. Here at The Forge, we explore what it means to live as Christian men. Along the way, we'll be doing weekly challenges to build character through action. We are by no means experts, just two young Christian men trying to make sense of a wild world.
That's right. We're doing our best to learn and hope you'll join us on the journey. And if you want to get directly involved, go to forginghonor.com to find information on how to join our community.
This is episode 15, Nameless Men in McCarthy.
Through a McCarthy novel. Now, in my counting, I want to clarify something here. I read for 5 of the 10 days. That said, I got so into my chosen work of McCarthy that I read the whole thing. So I accomplished the challenge. I just wasn't doing it for the second week. So I got 5 of the 10 days. But I consider that a win in terms of I achieved the challenge. Banjo, yourself.
I read nine days, and I had a little bit of an advantage over most people, I think, in that I have a large collection and a growing collection of McCarthy. So I finished The Crossing, which I was borrowing from somebody else. And then I was like, well, JJ is reading Blood Meridian. I got to review that. And you knew The Road better. So I reread The Road.
Right.
I finished The Road.
Oh, so you got through a lot.
Yeah. I'm about halfway through Blood Meridian. I ordered another book. I'm going to read Child of God next week.
If I'd been a good Forging Honor host, I would have also reread The Road. And then I had meant to actually read All the Pretty Horses, but I ended up letting someone borrow it. So I just, I went, well, I did read Blood Meridian, and I was very thrilled with it. I enjoyed Blood Meridian a lot. I have to say, I liked The Road more, which I know for you is a controversial opinion.
Well, no. So, yeah. And I, let's just get into it because no time to waste. I'm giddy about this episode. I mean, I am just thrilled to be talking about this with you, JJ. This is a lot of fun for me. So, yeah, let's just get into it. You love The Road. That's not a controversial opinion. That is easily his most well-known, most famous, most beloved book. Personally, it's not my favorite, but I think this comes from me because I'm not a father. You are a father. Real quick, give us the rundown. If someone's tuning into the show and they read a different McCarthy book, what's the 5-second rundown on The Road?
Well, I should heavy spoiler alert. I think.
Oh yeah,
Benjamin.
For all of the books that we're gonna read here,
100%. Not going to be holding off on The Road and probably Blood Meridian as well.
I might spoil The Crossing or All the Pretty Horses or any of
right.
those books.
I think it would
No
be,
Country for Old Men for sure.
I think, No Country for Old Men. Just saying, McCarthy's open for fair game on the spoiler side. I think we will do our best to stick to talking about the themes and stuff, but no guarantees on some of the specifics. With that said, if you're concerned about spoilers, you can stop listening now, or just skip straight towards the end where we do the next challenge. Or if you're not concerned about spoilers or you've read one of the McCarthy novels, I think one thing that's interesting about McCarthy is he is dealing with a lot of the same themes through his works. And I very much enjoy, at least what I've read of his. Banjo would be, know that better.
I will also say one thing that I've noticed the more I've read McCarthy is that the reread of McCarthy, the second time through a McCarthy novel, is significantly more rewarding than the first.
Right.
So once you know the end, it changes everything. And I think even if you haven't read the book before and you're not sure about whether or not you want to try McCarthy, maybe just check the episode out, hear how the book ends, and then your first time through, you might be able to make more sense of it.
Absolutely. All right.
So
with,
The Road.
With that said, synopsis of The Road. It is a post-apocalypse landscape. Already a point for me. I love post-apocalypse works and that kind of thing. It's a post-apocalypse landscape across which a father and son are struggling. I think the son, is he meant to be about 7 or 8?
He's young, yeah.
He's
eight
very
or nine.
Young.
Something like that.
And then I'm sure others have figured it out based exactly on contextual hints, but they struggle their way across the southeast of the U.S. A second point for me,
you know, it's through our old stomping grounds. They go past Lookout Mountain at one point.
Yeah, they do. And then over the Appalachians and hence out towards where my family lives in the Carolinas.
Yeah.
At any rate, so they're struggling across the wasteland across which marauding bands of other survivors of whatever caused this post-apocalypse landscape. We're never told what exactly caused it. We're given kind of hints, but we're never told exactly what it was. And then the father has this inner struggle of how do I keep myself and my son alive in a world where there's hardly anything to eat, where there are marauding bands of other survivors out to kill us, take our things, and probably eat our dead remains.
Cannibalism, a heavy theme.
It really is. And then how do we, I guess the central question of the book is, how do you pass on hope when there is no hope?
Yeah.
And I think that's the idea of carrying the fire. I think other people would agree with that. You know, you could kind of argue, what does it mean to carry the fire? What does it mean to have the fire? But that's a consistent theme in The Road particularly. So
yeah,
there's not a 5-second synopsis, but a 5-line synopsis maybe. Scores a lot of points for me just on the relatability front too. I don't have an 8-year-old son. I have a 1-year-old son. But I read The Road. It hit me in the perfect spot too, because I read it right after, for the first time, right after my son had been born.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, already is kind of rocking my world.
Yeah.
And then,
oh, that's perfect.
I'm reading this book where this father just, you know, it's all told from his perspective of how, you know, he has the internal thoughts and the struggles of a man who knows what he's up against. And he's trying to shield the boy from the reality of the world that they're in, even though it's impossible, right?
Right.
One aspect of, I think, McCarthy's writing is, and people talk about how violent it is. And it is violent. What's interesting is he doesn't ever describe the gory details to, like, at least in Blood Meridian or The Road. He doesn't describe the gory details to such an extent where it's like, I can perfectly picture it in my head. He does it in a way where it's just like this, the way he uses language, it's like, you know, the violence is happening. I mean, you can't stop it happening.
Yeah.
It's there, but it's, like, it's not like.
And you see it, but it's what. Here, let me, I've got The Road with me.
Okay.
If there's anything that McCarthy just like does better than anybody else, bar none, it's his first pages. I just love McCarthy's opening sentences and opening pages. And in The Road, he's describing the world. And on the first page, he says, when he woke in the woods in the dark and the cold of the night, he'd reached out to touch the child sleeping beside him. Nights dark beyond darkness, and the days more gray each one than what had gone before, like the onset of some cold glaucoma dimming away the world. And I love that line, like the onset of some cold glaucoma dimming away the world, because it's that kind of thing where it's like, it's what you're saying. It's not, he's not telling you, you know, the sky was this color and it had this aspect to
right.
it, it was these clouds. But it's describing this sense of this cancer that's growing. And so you feel the sense of dread and disease and waste that comes with that without using any of those words. You know, everything is carried in by inference, kind of what you're talking about. Blood Meridian does get kind of really explicit.
More so than The Road. And there are moments where it's much more explicit. But even so, Blood Meridian, how about you go ahead and give us a quick synopsis of that?
Yeah. One of the fun things about Blood Meridian, and this is true of great literature, even of The Road, where, you know, you can give a synopsis, but the synopsis falls so far short of what it feels like to read the book. So brief synopsis of Blood Meridian. It's a story actually based on a true story-ish of in 1849, after the Mexican-American War, there were bands of these roving marauders who would kind of go into the Texas, Mexico-American border territory. And their goal was to drive out the Native Americans who were there, and kill anyone that they found so that they could make room for settlers. And they were scalp hunters, and they would get paid by the scalp. So the story follows this young boy who's never named. He's just called the kid or the child. And he joins up, he's about 14 or 15. He joins up with one of these marauding bands. And there's a whole cast of characters that kind of go with that. But the most famous, vile, and prominent is the judge, Judge Holden, who's this enormous 7-foot bald-headed albino man who just kind of has this very strange, very evil presence throughout the book. And the struggle is really kind of between the child and the judge. And the question, it's kind of the inverse of the road. You know, we talked about the road is this, how do you carry hope in a world that has no hope? And Blood Meridian, the question is, what happens to people who try to be good in an evil world? I think is really the underlying question of that book. So you didn't like Blood Meridian as much.
I would not say I didn't like it. Just, yeah, as much. That's as the much. Key part. Because, as you said.
Let's start positive. What did you enjoy with it?
Oh, I loved the writing style of Blood Meridian.
It's so good.
I mean, I couldn't put it down. I mean, you know, I think one thing with both McCarthy books I've read is the first third is you got to have to get into it. But after that, I mean, once he gets in there, once you're drawn in, you can't stop. So I couldn't put it down after that first third of Blood Meridian.
What scene did you read that you were like, oh, I'm in? Like, at what point was it like, oh, I got there?
You know, I'm not sure there was a particular point as far as like, man, this is, I will say, I think when he first joined up with the Apache hunters, because, you know, towards the beginning of the book, he's just wandering and there's no sense of direction. Yeah. And I think that maybe that's intentional because as soon as he has, it's interesting, as soon as he's with the most vile, evil people that he's going to encounter on this trip, there's a sense of direction.
Yeah.
And that's when I think I really started getting into it, right? Because the story picked up. Up to that point, you know, I don't know. I will say that first, not very first scene, but that scene at the beginning where he goes to the revival.
Oh my gosh. I love that scene so much.
It definitely tells you this is the type of story you're in for. This is your opportunity to put this book down now.
Yeah.
And
it's not that he doesn't warn you. He gets, he gets so, very clear.
So
where
this
you're
scene.
Going. Describe it for us.
He goes in. The kid goes, he left his home of Tennessee and he's traveled all over. I can't actually remember where.
Yeah, let me just read the first page. Because the first page of Blood Meridian is so incredible. So this is, first page of Blood Meridian. See the child. He is pale and thin. He wears a thin and ragged linen shirt. He stokes the scullery fire. Outside lie dark turned fields with rags of snow and darker woods beyond that harbor yet a few last wolves. His folk are known for hewers of wood and drawers of water, but in truth, his father has been a schoolmaster. He lies in drink. He quotes from poets whose names are now lost. The boy crouches by the fire and watches him.
Night of your birth, 33. The Leonids, they were called. God, how the stars did fall. I looked for blackness, holes in the heavens, the dipper stove.
The mother dead these 14 years did incubate in her own bosom the creature who would carry her off. The father never speaks her name. The child does not know it. He has a sister in this world that he will not see again. He watches, pale and unwashed. He can neither read nor write. And in him broods already a taste for mindless violence. All history present in that visage, the child, the father of the man. And so this character who already has this already brooding in him, this mindless violence, steps into this, he's in this town, right, JJ? And then he gets in this, it's raining. And so he steps out of the rain into this revival tent.
Correct. He's in Texas. He steps into this revival tent where it sets the scene with, This minister has been leading a revival, I think, for like 5 days up to at this
point.
It's
been going on for a while.
Long revivals, but it's raining. So everybody's stepping in and out because they'll step
in. It's been raining for days.
They're stepping in and it's hot and it's humid from all the people packed in the tent. So then they step out and they get soaked in the rain and they come back in. That's the continual stream of people in and out of the tent. So the revival is going and then the judge walks in. And the judge starts accusing the reverend of all kinds of heinous sexual crimes of, you know,
not even being a minister.
Yeah, not even being a minister and just saying, yeah, he knows he did this thing a few days ago in this town. And
they all almost hung him.
Yeah. And finally, you know, he's going on about it and the minister's screaming lies, lies. And finally, a guy in the audience says, well, I should just shoot him right now. Like he texts us. He's like, well, just shoot him right now for these crimes. Like they're punishable by death anyway. So he just shoots him and then shooting breaks out in the tent. And they all leave. Then in a bar a little bit later, they encounter the judge and they ask him, oh, how'd you know these things about this man? Where'd you encounter him? He says, I'd never seen the man before today. He's just like, he made it up.
So what do you make of that? Like, who do you think the judge is?
Well, for one, I appreciate that that is so early in the book because yes, it does give you the warning of this is the type of man the judge is. And these are the types of things that will be occurring in this book. And the types of things that are immediately mentioned in the first couple of pages, you're just like, well, you can decide to put this down now. Obviously I didn't. but for that first encounter with the judge, I was like, wow, this is, I wasn't sure what to make of it. And I expected what's odd is you don't encounter the judge again for another,
it's like another 30 pages
chapters. Probably it's a while actually. And so because of that, I was like, well, is the judge just this character to set the tone of the book? I don't know, but he was sitting there in the back of my mind, right?
Yeah.
And then he pops up again in the middle of Mexico at where this kid is in prison. And it was like, I think it does a great job of having that first scene where there's a couple of characters, because he also encounters Toadvine there.
Yeah. And who is bizarre.
Who's just this strange outlaw character that's just along for the ride with the kid. I mean,
Toadvine's the one who's got the necklace of ears.
Yeah,
right?
Correct. He's got a necklace of ears and he himself is missing ears, which is interesting. So he collects other people's ears, but he himself is missing ears.
Yeah.
And he's been branded with HT for horse thief.
Yeah. And felon.
Oh yeah. The F for felon. So he's an outlaw convict. He just lives that life. So Toadvine kind of takes the kid under his wing. And it's this odd, kind of mentor relationship. And you know, like they kind of sort of respect each other. It's a strange relationship that is somehow healthier than everyone's relationship to the judge.
Yeah.
Because the judge, you realize like there are outlaws and then there's the judge. Right.
Yeah. 100%.
The outlaws wanton killing. They will go and you know, they're chopping the scalps off of men, women, children, all of them.
The scene where they describe the first Apache attack.
Yes. It's just
is
brutal.
So, oh my gosh. It's one of the most beautifully violent, horrible. I have to put the book down. I have to pick it back up. I have to put it down. I have to pick it back up.
The
gorgeous
scene.
The thing
that sets the judge apart is, so at one point, and this is where you know the judge is truly evil. He captures an Apache child, who, I mean, can't be more. I mean, the way he's described, he's like probably 2 or 3.
Yeah, it's a baby.
It's a very, very young toddler. And he takes this child, and he cares for him for like 2 days. And they're riding back across from this place where they've just killed this Apache child's entire family. And the outlaws, they're not sure what to make of it, but you know, they have whatever, it's a baby, like they don't really care. And then the judge is happily playing with the child, and then a moment later he kills the child just wantonly.
Yeah.
And the outlaws, the rest of the outlaws, like, they don't know what to do with that. Like Toadvine, what does he call the judge? Like Toadvine is openly disgusted by the judge for that action.
Yeah.
And he's an outlaw who's literally just killed women and children.
Yeah.
But like there's some difference for them in that cold blood versus we're writing in and this is our job situation.
And the scene where he kills the puppies.
Oh yes, the puppies.
You know,
which is so
brutal.
I was like, at that point, I think so the puppies occurs after the child, and it's like it somehow
the puppies is worse.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It felt like, well, the judge is gonna do this. Like when the puppies show up in the scene,
right.
I immediately know, well, they're going to be dead in the next page, so not don't get attached.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think that is really so much of the point of Blood Meridian is there is this huge force of evil in the world. And we could get into some real deep philosophical territory. I don't know how familiar you are with like the Gnostic heresy or anything like that, but
decent bit.
So the judge is a representation of some of the ideas in Gnosticism. Do you remember the part where he gets referred to as a Segeron? I guess how you say that word?
Yes. I think he calls himself that. I'm actually open on that page.
Yeah. That's a Gnostic term that has to do with this kind of evil force that kind of walks the earth and kind of has ownership over it.
Right.
Which gets to that scene on page 207 where he talks about he's the one who, you know, what's the line?
I should give some context here. So the entire time the judge is being simultaneously the single most evil character in the book, he is also the most learned, most scientific in the book. So what he does...
He's a Renaissance man.
Yeah, when they're not running around killing Apaches or wanting other civilians who get in their way, the very people they've been hired to help. He's cataloging in these little notebooks everything they come across. He's doing biology. He's taking butterflies. You know, he's doing the whole thing that you read about scientists of the Renaissance and Enlightenment doing. He can speak every language they encounter. He can just speak.
Yeah,
he already
just rattles it off.
And he's clearly very learned. He's very good. That's the other thing. Every time they encounter royalty or semi royalty, the any governors that they encounter of the Mexican government, he's the only civilized one that can speak to them appropriately in a civilized manner. Yeah. He knows the politics. He understands how to approach it, but he can also get up to the most debauchery of anybody. So then, he's someone is asking him of the outlaws. Someone's asking him, why do you catalog these things? What are you writing here? And he's trying to the judge is explaining to him, and he has this one line that sticks out to me. So he's writing in his ledger. He says, or the judge wrote on, and then he folded the ledger shut and laid it on one side and pressed his hands together and passed them down over his nose and mouth and placed them palm down on his knees. Whatever exists, he said, whatever in creation exists without my knowledge exists without my consent. And that line just threw me off. Like up to that point,
yeah,
I've been very able and willing to accept that, yeah, he can be a Renaissance man and he can do all these things and also be very evil. But then you get to this line and like that's the crux, I think, of his person in a sense. Because that's when you realize the whole world is centered on him.
Yeah.
And he recognizes that and he's okay with that. And he doesn't care about what anyone else thinks in the worst possible way.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you make of it? Were you able to reconcile it?
I mean, reconcile it in the sense of he's a terrible person and he's flawed. Yes. I mean, that's very evident in the book. I think I haven't yet figured out quite exactly, because I don't like doing this with authors. I don't like saying, well, what are they trying to say? Because a lot of authors.
Oh, but that's the point.
A lot of authors intentionally aren't trying to say anything. They'll say that.
Yeah, sure.
I think McCarthy, by the very fact that he writes philosophy directly into his books and he directly says what he's trying to say, you can 100%. Say that with him.
Yeah.
But I haven't figured out what he's trying to say with the judge.
Yeah.
You know, I know what he's trying to say in The Road, and maybe that's part of why I liked it a little more.
Right.
Like, it's very clear. It hit home. Mm-hmm. I was emotionally along for the ride. I mean, mm-hmm. I cried at the end of that book.
Oh, yeah.
I did not cry at the end of Blood Meridian. I sat down and went, what?
Yeah, we have to talk to you about the ending at some point. Here's the thing with the judge. And here's the thing they know about McCarthy is – And one of the reasons why I love him so much, McCarthy is doing something entirely, I'm going to say, braver than anybody else writing in American fiction right now, which is he's trying to say something. Exactly your point. You know, everybody is afraid to write a novel that can go up against the heavyweights like Hemingway and Faulkner. And McCarthy is like, let me, you know, give me the bat. Sometimes literally. one of the things that he's doing within the story is he's pulling in references to a whole lot of things. So he's a huge Herman Melville guy. Moby Dick is like his favorite book. There's a lot of Paradise Lost in this story. A lot of Mark Twain, a lot of Hemingway, all these classics. This scene where it's maybe my favorite scene in the whole book, but the scene where Tobin, the ex-priest, is describing how they escaped from the Indians that one
time.
Which,
by the way, I love that there's just an ex-priest along with this marauding gang. Like, it really shows the duality of man. Anyway, back to you.
Well, this scene where he's like, yeah, we were out of gunpowder, and so the judge took us to this volcano that was in the wasteland, and with a combination of charcoal, saltpeter, and urine made gunpowder. It's like,
well, he first spent days harvesting bat guano in order to acquire all of that. Like, they go to multiple locations to get everything.
It's the most bizarre scene and just absolutely bananas. But it's also a reference to John Milton's Paradise Lost. There's a whole scene in Paradise Lost where Satan is giving this speech to hell, basically. And everybody is, or what does it say? McCarthy's kind of like copying from it. Like, there's whole paragraphs and phrases that are kind of almost totally wholesale lynched from it, stolen from it.
How dare you? So, my high school teacher said I couldn't do that.
Well, Cormac, his famous quote is, books are made out of, the dirty little secret is that books are made out of other books, which I think is a great quote. But I was really confused on the judge too. I think it helps to know that he's referencing Moby Dick. So the judge is this big white whale of a man, much like in Moby Dick. Ahab is chasing after this white whale, and the white whale is kind of this evil force in some sense that kind of hangs over the story. The other thing to know about the judge is, and I'm getting this from a college professor at Covenant now, actually. The judge is the representation of the Enlightenment, right?
I definitely could sense that. Like, he's definitely, I know things and I can throw off God.
Right. And he's modern man, right? He's the modernist man who does away with all of the physical, violent, sexual mores of our time and says, I am the definer of life and death, and anything that exists beyond my knowledge exists without my consent, you know. And that's kind of why he has this forceful presence over the whole world.
That makes sense.
He's trying to tamp down everything that he can't understand, you know. And I don't think there is anything that the judge doesn't understand. I think he even understands himself as kind of this supernatural being a little bit. There's something
you kind of question that by the end, because he shows up again and it's been another 20 something years.
Yeah.
More than that, almost 30 years, kind of based on.
Yeah, the child's a man now.
Yeah, he's referred to as the man in the last chapter. And he shows up and he appears unaged, and he's out there getting up to all kinds of debaucheries. And he declares to anyone that'll listen right at the end that he will never die.
Yeah. Yeah, he says, this is on the last page. And they are he's in this scene. They're in a bar / brothel, and the judge is dancing and playing the fiddle. And it says, and they are dancing, the board floor slamming under the jack boots, and the fiddlers grinning hideously over their canted pieces. Towering over them all is the judge, and he is naked, dancing, his small feet lively and quick, and now in double time and bowing to the ladies, huge and pale and hairless, like an enormous infant. He never sleeps, he says. He says he'll never die. He bows to the fiddlers and sashays backwards and throws back his head and laughs deep in his throat, and he is a great favorite, the judge. He wafts his hat, and the lunar dome of his skull passes palely under the lamps, and he swings about and takes possession of one of the fiddles, and he pirouettes and makes a pass, two passes, dancing and fiddling at once. His feet are light and nimble. He never sleeps. He says that he will never die. He dances in light and in shadow, and he is a great favorite. He never sleeps, the judge. He is dancing. dancing. He says that he will never die. And it's this great haunting image.
Well, it makes you wonder, like, I mean, is he really, like, is he just a man? Like, up to that point, you believe, along right. with almost everyone else, that he is just a man. But there are hints dropped earlier that other characters in the story don't really think he's of this world.
Right.
And then right at the end, that leaves you wondering, I mean.
And it's not, he will never die.
Every single other character up to this point.
Yeah, the book says he will never die.
Correct, which makes you wonder, okay, so what does he think about it anyway? So there's all kinds of questions.
Yeah.
There.
And then you got to look at the epilogue, right?
Right.
So there's right after that, there's this really strange scene that describes, it says that there's a guy who's out digging holes and there's people behind him who are filling in the holes and they're gathering the bones. And it's really strange and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I had to do a lot of research to kind of figure out what was going on.
Aren't they digging fences or something?
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what it is. They're digging holes and they're filling fence posts. Yeah, he says.
Yeah,
have you never dug fence posts before? No, I never dug.
So it's given away right there. It says in the dawn there is a man progressing over the plain by means of holes which he is making in the ground. He uses an implement with two handles and he chucks it into the hole and he enkindles the stone in the hole with his steel hole by hole striking the fire out of the rock which God has put there. The two implements. I dug one the other day.
Oh really?
Yeah. So it's if you know what you're doing with post hole diggers, you know what that is.
Oh, okay. So what does it look? Is it like a jack? I don't know what it looks like. I've never had to do
I'll
it.
I can try to describe it. So there is, it's a two shovels essentially.
Oh,
connected
okay.
to each other by a lever. So the handles, you're able.
Yeah,
to pull
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Part and the bottom, the metal. Comes together in the shovels and grabs whatever's beneath them.
Okay. Yeah. 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 Okay. That makes sense.
So yeah, the two handles is what gave it away because that's the only tool. I mean, there's other tools out there with two handles, but that's the only one you use
good.
On the earth I know of.
That's funny because I read it and I was like, what is going on here? What? Because I mean, I've done farm work, but that's that particular job I've never had to do.
I've dug a lot of fence holes.
But
good shoulder workout. If you're ever looking my high school shoulders, much better shape than my now shoulders.
You get great shoulders, JJ.
We might have to, I don't know, cut that. I'm getting a little blushed over here.
Anyway, the scene here at the end is really about the closing of the West. You know, this is the last time that this world kind of exists.
Right.
You know? The frontier closes and this blood meridian is kind of the time where the judge rules in the West. It's time where this, like, it's a little bit hellish and there's this time for mindless violence that's kind of over everything. And now you have this westward expansion and the land is becoming civilized. And now we're kind of digging over it with these fences. But I think McCarthy's point is, it's still underneath everything that we're doing here. You know, there's something, and this is why it's one of the great American novels of the 20th century is this book is still present with us. You know, the events of this book all happened in some respect. All the book that he's pulling from, that McCarthy is pulling from, is an autobiography called My Confessions on a guy who is, it's a book written by a guy who was with the Glanton gang. Which was an group, yeah. Who is the kid and the judge? The judge is a real person, and Glanton is a real person, and all of the events that happened are kind of based generally,
reality.
Yeah. And I think you have to look at that and go, this really complicates the American dream, you know, and kind of the American myth, and what do we do with ourselves? And No Country for Old Men is really the same. Idea, you know. When's the last time you saw that movie?
It would have been college. Let's see. Which, speaking of kind of the realities of the history of America. Have you read Empire of the Summer Moon or heard any interviews with the Mm-mm, author of that no. book? I actually haven't read the whole book, but it is about the wars between the Texas Rangers and not the Apaches, but the Comanches.
Yeah.
During similar time frame. Mm-hmm. in Texas, same stuff's happening that's happening in Mexico in this book. And the things described by that author are just as bad, if not worse, than in Blood Meridian. And these actually happened.
Yeah.
To give you a picture. One, to be a Texas Ranger, you had to be able to shoot a dinner plate, I think from, was it 50 yards on a moving horse?
Jeez.
With the pistols at the time were not, you know, anywhere near as accurate as they are now. at a full gallop.
Right.
So they could do incredible feats of marksmanship. They were incredibly strong. But the average, if you didn't, what was the actual average? I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was a ridiculously high attrition rate. Basically, your chances of making it past your first year as a Texas Ranger were basically zero. Like you just didn't, they were just throwing everybody at the Comanches that they had.
Yeah.
And the Comanches were known, and the Texas Rangers then had to employ the same tactics that are happening in Blood Meridian.
Right.
In terms of just riding in, killing everybody, scalping them, getting out of there as fast as possible. Like that was happening. Both sides were doing it. It was the only way anyone could survive. What's crazy though, and there's a whole discussion that can happen here about providence and about the tides of history and the way God guides them. It's these things had been happening and were happening. It's remarkable. My one thought reading Blood Meridian like the whole time is this is fallen man entirely across the globe. 100%. This happens across the globe. To this day, these types of things happen.
Yeah.
And I mean, and sadly, I sometimes the United States contributes to some of that. And we have been contributing to that for a long time. I think I don't want to excuse anybody or any nation and say they're morally correct for doing so because everybody else is doing it. But I am saying everybody's doing it all the time. And it's this sad reality we live in. And that's the state of fallen man. Without God, man does this. Man hires Texas Rangers and goes after the Comanches who are killing everybody around them. I mean, the Comanches had an empire the size of the Roman Empire at one point that stretched. I mean, they enslaved thousands of other Native Americans.
Well, and you're absolutely right. Both sides are unrelentingly brutal. I mean, nobody gets out alive. There's in Cormac McCarthy.
The whole idea of the peaceful Indian sitting on the noble shores, savage. The noble savage, and then white man comes along, or at the same time, noble white man comes in and teaches the backward savage. Both are total. I mean, I don't want to say both are total lies because there's always the exception to the rule.
Right.
Both are essentially lies. I think it is only by the grace of God that any missionary ever braved any of that. On both sides. I mean, you talk about.
And only by the grace of God that any Native American was willing to accept the trust of a white man. You know, like both sides.
There's that, but also the fact that any, say, Texas Ranger or any local governor who's looking out for his own means. I mean, you look at the example of the British in India. They wouldn't let certain missionaries in because they knew if they let the missionaries in, then the Indians there would not, they would want their freedom.
Yeah.
Because that's what Christianity breeds.
Right. One of the things I think that is really compelling is the child, right?
Yeah, bring it back around.
Bring it back around. Let me. So the story, and I want to hit this fast and then look at it in No Country for Old Men. And then I think we have to end on the road to end with some hope.
Yes, we do.
But, you know, if you look at the child in Blood Meridian, he's the one who's kind. You know, he's kind of the exception to the rule.
And kind is a stretch.
But
like, he's noticeably different, but that still doesn't make him that much better.
No, he's not. But, you know, he's the guy who, you know, the one guy gets shot with an arrow and everyone is like, just leave him to die. Don't touch him. He'll kill you too. And the child is like, I gotta help him. I'm going to help him out. And takes the arrow out and heals him. And the judge, heavy spoiler alert, when the judge kills the boy at the end of the story, that's the reason that he gives is you were kind, you know, you were not fully committed right. to this mission. You have to die, you know? And I think that's the philosophy of the judge is to say all that, you know, it's an evolutionary mindset. Anything that does not survive is weak and must be expunged from the earth. And so I think as men in America, that's an idea we have to wrestle with, because that's an undertow. That's really, it's deep below the surface, and it's really easy right. to get pulled into. On the other hand, you know, looking at No Country for Old Men, which I think if you look at Blood Meridian as like the darkest place in McCarthy,
right,
pretty much. There's some other books I haven't read. They may be darker. I think The Road is kind of the most optimistic, mm-hmm. weirdly, that McCarthy gets. And then right in the middle, I think, is No Country for Old Men. Because I think at the beginning of that book, or that movie, if you've seen it.
Which you told me the movie is as faithful of an adaptation as probably,
I mean, pretty much.
Any book to movie adaptation can be.
Yeah, they cut out some stuff that it's not essential to the plot. You know, you don't watch No Country for Old Men and go, oh my gosh, they cut out this character. It's really faithful. But, you know, he's got that great speech at the beginning where he says, you know, the crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure. It's not that I'm afraid of it. I always knew you had to be willing to die to even do this job, not to be glorious. But I don't want to push my chips forward and go out and meet something I don't understand. You can say it's my job to fight it, but I don't know what it is anymore. More than that, I don't want to know. A man would have to put his soul at hazard. He would have to say, okay, I'll be part of this world. You know, it's like, it's almost yeah. like the Sheriff Ed Tom is looking at Blood Meridian. You know, it's in the same place. It's in the same physical location 140 years later. And he's looking at it and kind of going, you know, nothing's changed.
Right.
But I can't believe the violence that's here. I can't believe the terror that's here. And Anton Chigurh is the modern equivalent of the judge. You know, right. he's this terrifying, violent, seemingly all-knowing force that pushes its way across the desert.
Part of what makes the judge and Anton so terrifying is they're so sure of themselves. They have right. a very, very clear, well-thought-out philosophy.
Yeah.
Unlike everyone else around them who's
right.
floundering in this world, like you can almost forgive. So Glanton in Blood Meridian, you can almost forgive him for being as evil and vile as he is, because he's just doing what he knows to do, which is go kill for money.
Yeah. Right? And following the judge.
Yeah.
You know?
He's just along for the ride, and he doesn't know what to make of this world. The judge seems to know what to make of this world. And same with Anton. They seem to know what to make of this world.
Yeah.
And so they decide, well, with that, I'm going to go kill people. Like that's the conclusion they've come to. Like we would hope that if we figured the world out, we would come to a better conclusion, right?
Yeah, but that's the temptation, and that's the danger of living in a world as chaotic as this one. Is as soon as you see someone who you think they figured it out, like they have the answer, you go to them, and you know you do whatever they say because they
right.
they have the solution. You know, I think you can look around at any number of megalomaniac, maniacal figures in America or in world, you know, on the world sphere today, and say that's what's going on. You know, these are people who think they've figured out the world, and anyone who disagrees with them is gonna get the old Judge Holden treatment. You know,
right?
And I think that leaves the rest of us who want to have hope, who want to have, you know, kind of a Christ-centered view of the world in a very dark and scary place, because, you know, it's kind of what it says in the New Testament about, you know, the wisdom of God is held in the foolishness of men. You know, what mm-hmm. what God counts as wise, man counts as foolish. And I the scene that I keep coming back to is the end of No Country for Old Men, where, you know, he has those dreams, and I'm just going to read it because
yeah, go for it.
It's so good. Also, again, if you have not seen No Country for Old Men, it does not get better.
It's such a great movie.
Tommy Lee Jones reading this speech is so, it's incredible. I could watch it all day. Anyway, this is the speech from No Country for Old Men. He says, "Had dreams, two of them. Both had my father in them. It's peculiar. I'm older now than he ever was by 20 years. So in a sense, he's the younger man. Anyway, the first one I don't remember too well, but it was about meeting him in town somewheres and he gave me some money. I think I lost it. The second one, it was like we was both back in older times and I was on horseback going through the mountains of a night, going through this pass in the mountains. It was cold and there was snow on the ground and he rode past me and kept on going. Never said nothing going by, just rode on past. And he had his blanket wrapped around him and his head down. When he rode past, I seen he was carrying fire and a horn the way people used to do. And I could see the horn from the light inside of it, about the color of the moon. And in the dream, I knew that he was going on ahead and he was fixing to make a fire somewhere out in there and all that dark and all that cold. And I knew that whenever I got there, he'd be there. And then I woke up." And that's when the movie ends. And it's a great, it's the best ending of a movie, just period. And the book is great too. And I totally ruined it by geeking out about it like that, but I'm not going for the Oscar.
Well, I think you're not, I mean, it's a great book. You're like,
it's so good.
It's well worth geeking out about. The thing with that particular film, which I've only seen the movie, I haven't read the book, but the thing with that particular story itself is I think it does such a wonderful job of, showing each individual character and their, who they are, their motivations and what they're trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the sheriff's character there is like, at least in the movie, I don't know how much of this in the book, but in the movie, you don't really realize that he's, you know, kind of quote unquote the main character until near the end as other characters.
Well, he's behind everything.
Off. Yes.
You can tell the whole story of No Country for Old Men and never mention the sheriff.
Exactly.
You know, and he's the narrator in the book. And so he's kind of like, he's ending up catching up to all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never able to stop any of it.
He's always after the crime has occurred.
Exactly. And I just love that, you know, at the beginning, he's talking about, you know, you'd have to put your soul at hazard and say you'll be a part of this world. And I think that's the scariest thing in this world. And to go up against these forces that are so impossible, the Anton Chigurhs and the Judge Holdens. And I think that's why The Road is so powerful to wrap, you know, to get to a landing zone. Because really, we could do a whole two-part episode
100%.
On this.
The Road, though. You're right about that. I hadn't thought about that because, yeah, in The Road, the man has the opportunity to take himself out of the world multiple times.
Yeah. It's one of the big struggles of the story.
Right, because he has his revolver. And it's made pretty clear at the beginning. He has two bullets.
Yeah.
Two bullets at the beginning. And it's made clear he thinks one is for his son and the second is for him to relieve them both of this world. He never tells his son that. Right? He wants
no,
to...
No, well, the son knows that if they get attacked...
Right. Well, he goes...
He's supposed to...
He's supposed to turn it on himself. But his father tries to... I don't know. His father tries to shield him from the reality of what that is in his own way.
Yeah, and he says, you know, we're the good guys.
Right.
You know, and the kid still has the sense of like there are good people and there are bad people, even in this world that is apocalyptic, that is left behind, you know. There's still good and there's still evil and we're carrying the fire.
What's interesting to me is I think the pivotal scene there in The Road is he has these two bullets. And I mean, again, it's been a minute since I've read The Road, so correct me if I'm wrong here. But if I remember correctly, you know, they encounter a band of men. One of them grabs his boy.
Yep.
And I think he has a knife to him, and he's going to kill him. And in that moment, you realize with two bullets, the man has a choice, right?
Yeah.
He could just end it right there and then for both the boy and for himself. But instead, he shoots the man holding his boy.
Yeah.
Leaving one bullet.
Right.
They make their escape. Now he has one bullet. So that messes up his plans, right? Because now without the finding of more ammunition, he either has one more shot at defending themselves, and he can't bring himself to kill his son and then himself remain, but he can't bring himself to kill himself and leave the boy.
And leave the child, yeah.
And it leaves the struggle of the book just that's on your mind for the rest of the book.
Yeah. And I think if you connect the end of No Country for Old Men to really the whole story of the road, you know, you get the story of a father who's trying to go out into the darkness to prepare the fire in all that cold and all that dark. And trying to, you know, I think for McCarthy, part of the rule for fathers to sons, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as a father to a son, part of the role is to say, we're going to go out into the dark and prepare a place for our children, you know, and
we're going to try anyway.
Yeah. Try and make this thing worthwhile for them, even in the face of an evil that we can't overcome, you know? And I think there's something really powerful and beautiful. McCarthy often gets accused of being a too masculine writer, which I'd also like to hear what you think about that. But I think it's also a huge element, and there's a lot of scholarship on this, but he's got a huge thing about hospitality. And in every McCarthy book, there's kind of these scenes of like making food together and building a home together and making a livable space. And that seems to be as much a part of masculinity as the mindless violence. I don't know. How do you look at the road? You're a year later, you've got a son. You're thinking about these things.
Well, for one, I think every father should read The Road. I mean, if they're willing to stand up to some of the stuff inside of it, which I think ultimately that's what we're called to do as men and as fathers, is go out into the world and stand up to its darkness. I mean, again, only by the grace of God can we do that. I'm not saying go leave your nice home and go find that, but
find the judge, whatever you do.
Don't go find the judge. Look for it. Work through these thoughts and work through it, and then try to live it out in your everyday a little bit. I think, as far as the accusation of the books being too masculine, I don't think that's a problem. Maybe they are. I think they are more masculine than they are feminine in a sense. I'm not denying that. But I don't necessarily think that's an issue considering the types of stories he's telling.
Yeah. Are there any parts of like a McCarthy book or McCarthy men that you look at and you go, I want to be like that. That's the kind of man I want to be. Or the kind of man I don't want to be. Or like, I don't agree with that.
Yeah. There's no one in Blood Meridian that I want to be like. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I imagine someday I'll sympathize with the sheriff a lot. In No Country for Old Men. But yeah, in The Road, it's very easy for me to put myself in that father's shoes.
Yeah.
And to understand the struggle he's going through. Because
I actually love... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
You love...
No, you go.
Okay.
I insist.
I think the struggle of the father makes sense from a young man's perspective, and the sense of the world often feels like the world he is physically in.
Yeah.
It feels like, I think, at least for me anyway, I can be kind of mentally and emotionally in, right? You know, it feels like everything beyond my immediate surroundings is dark and dreary, and I'm not entirely sure what's out there, what's next. Other times it doesn't feel that way, but at its worst it does. And I think struggling through that, and yeah, oftentimes it is, I mean, love for my son that gets me up in the morning.
Yeah. Right.
That's the thing. I'm like, cause I wouldn't be doing this for me at this point. Like it just,
you gotta live outside of yourself.
You gotta live outside of yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
And you have to have something to hold on to.
Yeah. No, that's really great. I think not being a father, the two stories that speak the most to me right now are probably No Country for Old Men. Blood Meridian is my favorite McCarthy book, for sure. But there isn't a character that I'm like, oh, I want to be like that. But No Country for Old Men, and then All the Pretty Horses.
I'm looking forward to reading that.
Yeah, I really love All the Pretty Horses. It's a much kinder read than Blood Meridian, but it's like you get a little bit more of the hope from The Road, and a little bit more of the West from Blood Meridian.
It's part of a trilogy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the first one in the trilogy, and it's much more easy to read than the other two. Like, it almost feels like a regular book. But John Grady Cole in that book is the protagonist, and he's just a lot of fun. Like, of all the characters in a McCarthy book, he's the one that I'm like, I would want to hang out with this guy. He seems cool. And that book, you know, there's a lot of really interesting things to talk about with pain and suffering there, but it's nice to read a McCarthy book and be like, I like this guy. I want to be with this guy. So that's my encouragement for All the Pretty Horses. If when you get the chance to read that one, I think
that makes sense. And I think, I don't think McCarthy is necessarily trying to give us people to be like, at least in the ones I've read.
No, definitely not.
He's more exploring. He's throwing a lot of the world at you and saying, how do you respond to this?
Yeah. Yeah. And he's really challenging our modern sensibility of it. You know, I think if you look at the very first page of Blood Meridian, like before the story even starts, there's those three quotes. You see that, you know where I'm talking about?
Yep, yep.
And it says, there's a quote here from the Yuma Daily Sun. Clark, who led last year's expedition to the Afar region of northern Ethiopia, and UC Berkeley colleague Tim D. White also said that a reexamination of a 300,000-year-old fossil skull found in the same region earlier showed evidence of having been scalped. You know, and
right.
I think his point with including that is saying this is not common, or this is not uncommon in humanity. You know, this isn't just like, oh, this happened in this one particular time, in this one particular place. There's some of this, Cain and Abel violence that is just inbred into us as human beings.
Every society. I mean,
yeah,
it's remarkable how reading history, it shocks me that I live in a world where I'm not encountering death every day, right? That's right. Just part of how society used to be. Whether it was you were inflicting it upon someone else or just witnessing it or suffering because of it.
And we think of ourselves as more evolved because of that. And, you know, I think right. It's a privilege and a blessing that we get to live in a time where we're not killing each other every day. But I think McCarthy's point is
time and place.
Time and place. And this is inherent to us. Like, it's not like these parts of ourselves go away just because the right. time does. You know, this part of our soul is still there. So how do we make sense of that? I think sometime we'll have to do a return to Cormac McCarthy because there's so much here to talk about. But I think one of the things with a McCarthy book is to say, to counterbalance the judge. You know, the judge is the modernist, the Enlightenment Renaissance man who says that all that exists is what I know. Nothing exists without, anything that exists outside of my knowledge exists without my permission. And I think McCarthy is saying there is something that exists without our permission, without our knowledge. It's the soul, the spiritual. There's something beyond what we see
right.
that exists, and we have to make sense of that. And we can't live a full life not understanding that spiritual side of ourselves. That being said, he's an incredible scientist. He's not a scientist, but he's very familiar with scientists. I mean, he had frequent
right.
discussions with like Oppenheimer and all these guys. Not with Oppenheimer, about Oppenheimer. Yeah. Anyway, so much more we could talk about.
Yeah, we're running out of time here.
You gotta cut me off, JJ. Any last thoughts that you wanna?
I feel like
get into?
We leave so much. As McCarthy does to his characters, we have taken his books and left them strewn about all over.
A most unscientific study.
At any rate, I think ultimately, I guess the way to wrap this up would be to talk about it from the challenge perspective. what did we learn from reading, picking a book and reading through it intentionally for this purpose? And then two, how would we go about continuing these types of efforts, if any?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a part of that question is, why McCarthy in the middle of that?
Yeah. Yeah, those are good questions. I think I walked away from this challenge, one, as a person who loves writing, just I'm head over heels in love with these books. So there's that. But on the other hand, I think Robert Frost has a quote where he says that poetry is when we make a momentary stay against confusion. We make this kind of small enclave, this small fort against the chaos that rages outside of us. And I think McCarthy is just really helpful to start to put a finger on some of those forces of chaos that exist around you, right, and inside you, and to start to wage war against them. You know, I think it's easy to read scripture and to go to church every Sunday and to hear the things that we always hear and to get those lessons that we always get and to kind of reduce sin and suffering to, you know, the 5 or 10 things that we work on every week. But I think you read McCarthy and you right. go, oh, there's something else inside of me that I have to deal with. You know, mm-hmm. there's something beyond me that I don't understand that I need to get a grip on. And I think at his best, that's what McCarthy points us towards and helps us with, to awaken us to the darkness inside and darkness around us. And I think to offer some hospitality, you know, even to look at folks who are different from us, you know, to challenge us with, you know, look what our ancestors did to Native Americans, you know, or look what the Native American ancestors did to our forefathers. Like, in the gospel, we have to make peace with that, you know, because every tribe and tongue right. and nation will be present. And I think we need to say, all right, how do I make peace with that? And how do I live out the reality of that transcontinental union in this life? I don't know. You think you have any thoughts on those things? Answers to those questions?
Not especially in response to what you just said. As far as the challenge goes, I appreciated that we did this. I appreciated that we took a dive into a particular author. I think, yeah, just picking several of his works, semi at random, was good. Doing kind of a study of an author in that way as a challenge was something I haven't really done, and I enjoyed it. I think I'd like to do it again with some other authors, actually, and just mm-hmm. kind of work through several of their works.
Tolkien manliness would be an interesting.
That'd be fun. Having already worked through most of what he has to offer. at any rate, I will say with McCarthy especially, I think for me, the thing with him is similar to what you were talking about, just that contrasting of the human soul with what he writes as soulless landscapes, contrasting that with the reality I know of it would be this, but for the grace of God, it would yeah. be this way for me, but for the grace of God. Like that's all I could think reading Blood Meridian is, man, it's a miracle that any of this place was settled in a quote unquote civilized way eventually.
Yeah.
Like it never should have happened.
Yeah.
That's all I can really respond to with that.
Yeah.
And especially with books like The Road, just the hope that is presented at the end of The Next Generation Lives On.
Yeah.
They'll do what they have to do, and all we can do is try to set them up for success.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always a looking forward, and there's that fire, and there's that hope. And there's that reason to hope. And I think McCarthy's hope can be hollow sometimes. And because there isn't really.
Yeah, I do wonder about that.
I don't know what if he was a Christian or not. He was famously reclusive and didn't give a lot of interviews. So yeah. I don't know, but I, you know, I don't, I don't get that sense from his novels.
Yeah.
But I think as Christian men, we got to look at, you know, carrying the fire for us, I think, isn't just, oh, well, we're going to keep the species going. But it's also because there's no promise that that happens outside of Christ. But further, right. we have, you know, the surest of hopes, the greatest of hopes that our salvation is already accomplished and applied. You know, our resurrection hope is sure. And we have that conviction of things unseen. And I think greater than hope, we have faith, you know. And so I think that's the fire that we can carry for ourselves and for the next generation.
Amen. All right, on to the next challenge. As a reminder, challenges last for 10 days. That's Monday through Friday for 2 weeks. So we were kind of at a loss with after McCarthy. Like, what is the next?
Where do you go after this?
And I think one thing that we are wanting to explore a little more is man's place in this world, our place in this world as young men. I think so the challenge out of that is pretty straightforward. And it's literally be in this world. It's go outside intentionally. So if you already work outside, this is separate from that working outside time. This is separate for me from the time I spend outside just because I happen to be outside. This is intentional. Go out on your own, go outside. Did we set a time, Banjo? I think
15 like minutes.
15 minutes. Just go outside 15 minutes. You could even do what's called have you heard of earthing or grounding?
I think so. I've heard of nature bathing.
It's something my doctor actually recommended. He's just as a good health practice. Basically, be barefoot outside. We spend a lot of our time in our shoes or indoors on hard surfaces. Going outside onto the soft surface of the dirt and the grass is apparently good for you. I don't know. I haven't really tried it. I'm going to try it. And the idea and the goal with this is, kind of ground yourself in one, we live in a physical reality, kind of, but also, Banjo, you were expressing some wanting to, I mean, how'd you put it?
Well, two things. One, you know, one of the things you come away with from McCarthy is just a sense of place, you know, just that bizarre magic that comes from kind of looking at the Texas wasteland that he sees. And part of his writing comes from how well he knows the land. So I think, you know, that's part of what we're trying to talk about. The other part is, especially when you're looking at McCarthy, you get the overwhelming transcendent feeling of nature. You know, like when you go to the ocean, if you go to the beach and you're like looking out at all that water, you're like, there is something here that is so much bigger than me. You know, or you go to the Rockies and you're at the base of Pikes Peak and you're looking up and you're like, that is awe-inspiring.
One of my favorite things is driving out west, and when you first see the mountains,
that first glimpse,
crossing the plains, it's just like there's something massive over there.
Yeah,
it's so cool.
Yeah, especially after all the Kansas flat.
It's been pretty boring.
Yeah, and I think it's a good analogy for what we're looking for because, and this may be difficult depending on where you live or what's going on, but. You know, I think the goal is to find some place where you have that sense of being a very small human being, because the temptation for us is to think that we're the judge, you know, to think that we exist larger than all the rest of creation. And I think we need to find places, whether that's floating on a lake or going for a hike or just kind of going for that walk and seeing the expanse of sky where we touch the transcendent, you know, that thing that's bigger beyond us. And we leave this kind of day-to-day framework of reality. I've been talking a lot about like finding the spiritual in life. And, I'm kind of pushing for that, you know, find that place
where you
realize there's more to life than I,
well,
than
and
I
to expected. Clarify, not like be in the, weird. Ooh, God is everywhere.
Not a new
sense.
Agey.
Not in
yeah.
That sense.
Not a pantheistic.
We're not. Yeah. Not pantheism. God is in the trees, kind of stuff.
Right.
But yeah, that sense of place. I think that's a great phrase for one.
finding a sense of being a created being.
Correct.
You know,
putting yourself and realizing God made all of this. Here I am.
Yeah.
What can I do but worship? I think that's the goal of this. So simple, 15 minutes outside. That is intentional for outdoor time.
Yeah. And before we wrap this section up, we should also just toss out there, if you guys have any challenges that you would like for us to give a whirl, any things that you're interested in seeing on the podcast, let us know. You've got the Discord or the website.
Absolutely.
Give us a shout. We want to know. Hit us up on Twitter or on Instagram. Let us know what kind of challenges you want to see from us.
Very good. I'm looking forward to this one. This will be nice and peaceful after reading Blood Meridian.
Yeah, this will be a good detox. This has been the Foraging Honor podcast. Music and production is by Elliot George. For more information about what we do or to learn how to get involved, visit our website at foraginghonor.com. If you enjoyed the show, make sure to like, subscribe, and give us a rating to bring others into the Foraging Honor journey.
On our website, you'll find information on how to do the challenges alongside us, as well as links to the many resources we mentioned in the show.
And we do make a small amount from any purchases you make through our website links, so thank you in advance.
Thanks for taking time with us today. We hope you'll take up the work alongside us and join us in the task of Foraging Honor. We'll see you next time.